to an anomaly, the test was terminated near the launch pad shortly after liftoff to ensure public safety.
A rocket from the Kodiak launch complex self-destructs early this morning. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 25th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, finding housing for people who end up in Unalaska with no job and no money.
When I came here, you know, I was like kind of scared. I just kept thinking about it, like, well, what are we going to do and stuff like that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek salmon fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com.
A team of scientists is descending on a former nuclear test site in the Aleutians today to search for damage from a massive earthquake. Mark Kautsky oversees Amchitka for the Office of Legacy Management at the U.S. Department of Energy. Kautsky says they weren't supposed to visit the island for another 2 years. Then a 7.9 quake struck pretty close to the old nuclear sites in June.
Like 25 miles north of the island. It's actually also 70 miles below the surface, so we don't expect that there was any deformation in the area under the island.
And that means probably no release of radioactive material. Since the last detonation on Amchitka in the early 1970s, there haven't been any leaks detected in the marine environment. But this earthquake might have shifted things above ground. The island holds 7 cells full of drilling mud from the nuclear tests, all contaminated with diesel fuel. They're covered with soil, and Kautsky says they need to stay that way.
So we'll do a walk around on the covers, and if there's any indication that the slopes have failed on the side slopes. That's evidenced by things like slumping.
While those tests are underway, researchers from the Alaska Volcano Observatory and the University of Alaska Fairbanks will install new monitoring equipment on Amchitka, and it's a critical link in the state's tsunami detection network. The expedition to Amchitka is expected to wrap up by Wednesday. The Narrow Cape area beyond the Kodiak launch complex will remain closed to the public until further notice after this morning's rocket explosion, according to an announcement from the Alaska Aerospace Corporation. KMXD's Jay Barrett has more.
Pentagon spokeswoman Maureen Schumann said the U.S. Army rocket self-destructed just 4 seconds into its flight at about 12:25 this morning.
Shortly after 4 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, the U.S. Army Space and Missile Defense Command, Army Forces Strategic Command, as part of the Defense Department's Conventional Prompt Global Strike Technology Development Program, conducted a flight test of the advanced hypersonic weapon. Due to an anomaly, the test was terminated near the launch pad shortly after liftoff to ensure public safety. There were no injuries to any personnel. Program officials are conducting an extensive investigation to determine the cause of the flight anomaly.
It was the first launch at the KLC in 3 years. Alaska Aerospace CEO Craig Campbell said he couldn't verify where debris from the rocket came down, but Schumann said it was her understanding that the debris is limited to KLC property and did not fall into the water. The 3-stage solid fuel rocket is based on refurbished Polaris intercontinental ballistic missiles. Campbell said it did not appear from a preliminary estimate that there was any extensive damage to the Kodiak launch complex, but said AAC and Department of Defense personnel will be doing damage assessments all day. Kodiak resident Stacy Studebaker, who owns a home in nearby Passagshack, has long been a critic of the Kodiak launch complex. She said in an email to KMXT that she wanted to know what kind of hazards any unburnt rocket fuel posed and who will be conducting the cleanup. 2 popular recreation areas are adjacent to the KLC, Fossil Beach, which remains off-limits, and Surfer Beach. In the nose cone of the rocket was the Army's Advanced Hypersonic Weapon, which is a rocket-launched glider capable of flying at over 3,500 miles per hour, or Mach 5. According to the Army's description, the small craft is designed to be lofted nearly into space before separation and then glide through the atmosphere to its target at hypersonic speeds. If developed, it's expected to be able to hit any target on Earth within an hour or less with conventional non-nuclear explosives. This was to be the second test of the glider. Its target was the Kwajalein Atoll in the South Pacific. The first test was successfully launched from Hawaii. Scott White, a Kodiak photographer, was watching the launch from Cape Greenville in Chiniac, about a dozen miles from the launch site. He said even at that distance, the explosion was very loud. Another photographer at Cape Greenville said the launch looked out of control from the beginning and that she wasn't surprised to find out it self-destructed. She said the resulting fire burned brightly for a short while. The Kodiak Launch Complex is about 25 miles from the city of Kodiak. I'm Jay Barrett.
A woman inmate died this morning at the Matsu pretrial facility in Palmer. 37-year-old Tisha Rochdi was found unresponsive in her cell around 6:30 this morning, according to the State Department of Corrections. Sherry Daigle is Deputy Director of Administration for the Corrections Department.
The female inmate was actually in a dorm-type setting with 19 other female inmates. The other inmates did notice that she was unresponsive. They notified corrections officials immediately, and corrections staff responded and began CPR and notified emergency medical services, and an ambulance responded.
Rochdi was pronounced dead shortly past 7 this morning after CPR efforts failed. The state medical examiner's office will conduct an autopsy to determine the cause of death. According to Alaska State Troopers, there is no sign of foul play. Daigle says in light of a hearing on prison deaths conducted earlier this summer, the Corrections Department has made changes in its death investigation policy and information about the death is made public online. Rochdi was in prison on probation violation charges related to a felony DUI. A pilot and passengers were hurt in a plane crash in the Brooks Range on Sunday. National Transportation Safety Board Alaska Region Chief Clint Johnson says the single-engine Navion operated by Kirst Aviation of Fairbanks went down in Attigan Pass near mile 244 of the Dalton Highway.
Four individuals on board. Injuries range from serious to critical, and they were medevaced last night.
Johnson says the crash was witnessed and first responded to by Trans-Alaska Pipeline workers. Alaska State Troopers report that the Alyeska crew was able to get the injured pilot and passengers out of the wreckage and to a nearby airstrip for evacuation to a hospital. Johnson would not speculate on a cause of the crash.
Whenever the pilot's health allows, we want to be able to talk to him to get it firsthand exactly what took place. However, his injuries are not going to allow us to do that for probably the next couple of days.
Johnson says the plane went down about 400 feet below the top of the 4,800-foot pass close to the highway and pipeline. He says the pilot had filed a VFR flight plan to take the passengers from Fairbanks to Bettles, Dead Horse, Barter Island, and back to Fairbanks.
Preliminary information would indicate that they were cruise passengers. We don't know exactly which cruise line that they were, but they were visitors, and we understand they are from Canada.
Johnson says the NTSB is working with the Federal Aviation Administration in Fairbanks, and troopers are on the crash investigation. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, documenting the traditional foods of the Aleutians in a new cookbook.
That is the easiest way to describe it because it has recipes, and I'm at fault for even sometimes calling it that. But really, it is a lot more than a cookbook.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here.
About 60 people attended a rainy campaign rally on the steps of the Capitol building for Democratic gubernatorial candidate Byron Mallott on Sunday. KTOO's Jeremy Shea reports.
Mallott's stump speech was about 9 minutes long. He hit themes of respect for organized labor and public employees, and serving Alaskans in all communities of all cultures. Malott pledged to
reach out, listen, consider, heed the voice of every single Alaskan.
His voice was hoarse from campaigning. He was sipping tea from a thermos after his address. The nod to labor comes after trying to court the Alaska AFL-CIO's endorsement at a convention in Fairbanks last week. The Alaska Dispatch News reported that the labor union opposes Republican Governor Sean Parnell, but would not endorse a challenger unless Malott and independent Bill Walker merge their campaigns. Polls indicate the three-way race favors incumbent Governor Sean Parnell, while a two-way race would be much closer. On Sunday, Malott maintained his commitment to run as a Democrat.
Well, you know, polls in Alaska can be unreliable. There hasn't been a lot of polling. The general election is just beginning. We have a long way to go.
Running mate Hollis French lumped Walker and Parnell together.
This race is going to offer Alaskans a very simple test for who they want to be the next governor. You can have an oil company lobbyist.
That's Parnell, who used to lobby for ConocoPhillips.
An oil and gas attorney.
That's Walker, an Anchorage lawyer with an emphasis in oil and gas.
Or the man who ran the Permanent Fund.
And that's Malott, who was executive director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation from 1995 to 2000.
And I think once the state realizes that's their choices, everything's going to be fine.
The general election is November 4th. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
In June, the Division of Elections rejected David Neese's candidacy because his filing papers weren't notarized. Now the Anchorage Republican plans to run for state house anyway, even if it means a write-in campaign that could pit him against another member of his party. Neese had originally wanted to participate in the party primary for House District 22. When he found out his candidacy had not been certified, he appealed the decision. The court system still hasn't made its final ruling on the matter, so Neese is preparing to run as a write-in if he can't get his name on the ballot.
We're still campaigning. We just don't know whether it's going to be write-in David or David's going to be on the ballot, and it'll be confusing for voters because you'll have two Republicans and a Democrat in that district.
Neese would go up against fellow Republican Liz Vasquez and Democrat Marty McGee. Their district covers the Sand Lake neighborhood of Anchorage, and the House seat is being vacated by Republican Mia Costello, who is making a bid for the Senate. Neese says one Republican group has discouraged him from running out of concern that he could split the vote with Vasquez. Neese says he's not trying to, quote, disrupt the Republican process, unquote, and he thinks it's better for voters to have more options.
I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's very important that somebody go out and challenge the system.
Democrat Marty McGee says he welcomes Neese to the race. Vasquez did not return a message left on her phone. Unalaska attracts thousands of transient workers every year, lured by the promise of a steady paycheck, but marine industry jobs can fall through, leaving people stuck with no shelter and no money to fly home. Community groups have stepped up to help, and now, as KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, one nonprofit is ready to expand its safety net for stranded workers.
The apartment next door to the Unalaska Christian Fellowship is simple. Just a couple of couches, some sleeping bags, and a whiteboard inscribed with Bible verse.
This is home sweet home, with the bathroom and the laundry and the little kitchen area in this area here. The most people that I put in here is four. And if for some
John
reason,
Honan is the pastor at the church and the head of Alexandria House. For the last 20 years, this nonprofit's been finding spare beds and even buying plane tickets home for folks in need.
You get to meet some amazing people that have been through horrific things. So we'll do what we can to help them on their way.
Honan sees it happen every day. People fly in expecting to find work in the fishing industry, but it's not always there, or it doesn't last. When people get stuck, two local groups can offer help. USAFE serves mostly women and children, while Alexandria House is geared more towards single men. The women's shelter gets grants from the city, among other sources, but Alexandria House is a ministry, and they've never had a steady source of funding, until now. They're planning to open an apartment and storefront in Unalaska's historic downtown. The space used to be filled by the Elbow Room Bar. It was an infamous dive in its day.
Yeah, you can see that. It was pretty bad, so it's got to be repaired all the way around.
Alexandria House got this building as a donation 5 years ago. When they're done renovating it, Honan says the space will be rented out. The money will go toward hotel reservations or airfare for stranded people. It's a big deal for Honan's organization, but it wasn't his original plan. He wanted to turn the building into a homeless shelter. Neighbors like Susie Golodoff weren't happy. Her family's lived next door to the old bar for decades, and she's had her fill of strangers wandering her streets.
So I've no objection to being a, you know, a kind-hearted community. We should help each other, and we're known for that in Unalaska. However, I think that we also need to respect the older people that have lived here all these generations, and this part of town is the old historic part of town.
That's the argument she and her neighbors made in a petition to Unalaska's Planning Commission back in 2009. The board ruled in their favor. Honan couldn't use the building as a shelter. So he changed tack. When he came back with his current plan for a rental property, some neighbors were still opposed, but the zoning board couldn't say no. Planning Director Aaron Reinder says the neighborhood is zoned to fit an apartment, and given the housing shortage in Unalaska, it made sense to approve the ministry's plan.
A side benefit of that is that then it supports an organization that's already identified under emergency housing to actually do that mission as well.
Reinder says the best spot for a shelter would be way across town, on the Dutch Harbor side, home to the airports, stores, and most of the industry jobs. That's where Jarek Reyes lives, in a bunkhouse provided by his employer. Reyes moved to Unalaska almost a year ago, thinking he could find a high-paying job. But there was no work and nowhere for him to stay.
When I came here, you know, I was like kind of scared. I was like, I just kept thinking about it, like, what are we going to do and stuff like that.
He heard about Alexandria House and reached out to John Honan. Soon, Reyes was living in the apartment next to the church. He had to follow some ground rules, no drinking, no drugs, and mandatory prayer meetings twice a day.
I'm Catholic myself, but I still read the Bible, and I know there's like similarities between the two. So, I mean, I got along with it, and I was fine.
Reyes stuck it out, and after a few weeks, he landed the job he'd hoped for. And that's how emergency housing should always work, says John Honan. He hopes the money from his new apartment will make it easier to get more people to that point. Honan's building should open this winter, but he's not sure who the first tenants will be. He wants a couple or a family to sign a long-term lease, which would mean long-term income for Alexandria House.
We have no salaries. We're not paying anybody anything. So all the money, apart from obviously, you know, building maintenance, whatever, can go to make sure people are cared for every night.
Whoever moves in will have the right to invite guests to stay with them. And if they want to take in stranded folks for Alexandria House, Honan says that'll be their decision. And that means neighbors will be watching closely, and so will the rest of a town, where getting stranded's always going to be a possibility. John Honan's project is a small step, but it's still progress, as workers keep coming here in search of better chances. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
Nome has been experiencing a summer of urban muskox, where the uniquely shaggy Arctic mammals have made their home close to town, threatening dogs and occasionally people. Now the same thing has happened more than 100 miles west of Nome in the community of Wales. Helena Oxerock was using a four-wheeler to haul water with her boyfriend on Saturday, August 16th, when she noticed a shaggy muskox bull come from behind her house. Despite neighbors and family members yelling and revving their four-wheelers to scare the animal off, she said the bull ignored them until it noticed her dog, Sam.
And then it started chasing my dog around his house maybe six times. So when my dog had to run away from it. And at one point it got to where my dog was being pushed, but not really hurt, pushed by the muskox's head. And I'm glad the chain didn't get caught on his horns. Otherwise, he would have been in big trouble.
Oxerock says her brother Randy went inside, grabbed his rifle, and shot several warning shots in the air, but the muskox was unfazed.
It didn't even budge. It just looked at my brother like nothing happened. Then it started chasing my dog Sam again.
That's when Oxerock's brother shot the animal, first in the shoulder, but later in the neck and head. Oxerock says her brother called the Alaska State Troopers to report the kill. Alaska Department of Fish and Game Assistant Area Biologist Letty Hughes confirmed the clean defense of life and property take on Friday. Oxerock says, in keeping with the requirements of LP Wildlife Takes, she and her family immediately butchered the animal and shared the meat with friends in the community. The bull was the second muskox death in Wales in as many weeks. Fish and Game's Hughes says the department investigated a dead muskox a few miles outside of the community last week, but determined the animal had died after being gored by another muskox. Food has been a crucial part of the Unangan culture for centuries, but in the Aleutian and Pribilof Islands, people are relying less on the land and sea and more on their local store. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports on a new effort to promote subsistence living in print.
From sweet Russian tea to fermented fur seal flipper, the traditional diet in the Aleutians and Pribilofs has always been pretty varied. But a decade ago, Suanne Unger realized it might be starting to fade. She was in the villages of St. Paul and Atka to interview people about their eating habits.
There were comments like, you know, my grandmother passed away and she used to be the one that cooked traditional foods with us. Or, I don't know how to prepare traditional foods. We were getting all sorts of feedback that indicated that some loss of traditional food production knowledge was taking place.
That raised a red flag with Unger. She's a researcher for the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association, and she says traditional foods cut the risk of diabetes. Plus, gathering them is good exercise. So Unger applied for a grant from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and used the money to make a recipe book for the Aleutian and Pribilof Islands.
That is the easiest way to describe it because it has recipes, and I'm at fault for even sometimes calling it that. But really, it is a lot more than a cookbook.
It's called Kakamiroch. That's the Aleut word for subsistence, and it covers a lot more ground than just cooking. Unger wove in dozens of interviews with elders about their best practices for hunting, their safety tips, and even detailed nutritional facts.
Like the iron, for example, that's found in stellar sea lion meat, or, you know, the protein found in reindeer.
That way, readers can make comparisons to the store-bought products they've come to rely on. But Unger says those are probably here to stay. Whether it's commercial fishing or construction, a lot of residents in the region are part of the cash economy now, and they don't have time for subsistence. Julia Dushkin has seen that change firsthand in Unalaska.
Well, it's hard nowadays because to go out hunting and everything, like sea lion, for instance, that's hard to get, you know. And I love sea lion meat out versus seal and that other stuff.
Dushkin is standing in the middle of Unalaska's annual culture camp. For 1 week, elders stop their daily routines and teach traditional skills, like this.
Don't cut the skin, huh?
Larry Dirks is showing a 10-year-old how to fillet her first salmon. Olivia Betson glides her knife through the meat until it slips out of her slimy hands.
I better use this one.
Olivia reaches for a blade with a bumpy handle, and she makes the last few cuts.
Yeah, that should do.
Oh, no, mom. Got it?
Yep. We're all done, huh?
As Olivia carries her salmon up the beach, Larry Dirk starts washing his knives. He works for Unalaska's Department of Public Safety now, but he learned to fish and hunt back home in Atka.
Filleting fish and all that, you know, takes years. It took me years to do it, to get good at it, but to start anyways for those kids.
It's the kids that Suanne Unger wants to target next. Eventually, she hopes her subsistence book will make its way into the classroom.
You know, my dream would be to take this and create some curriculum out of it and have it for teachers to pick up throughout our region. I don't know if, you know, we'll be able to manage to get something going soon, but that would be the direction I'd like to see this take.
Along with hands-on learning, it could help create a new generation of hungry students. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Many students across the state started school last week, including kids on the Kenai Peninsula. Before the big day, some kids in Homer still needed to check items off their supply lists, and a group in town was there to help. KBBI's Quentin Chandler has more.
On Monday, the food pantry at the Homer United Methodist Church was filled with families lining up for their chance to pick up fish fillets, beans, rice, and other necessities. But before they reached the food, a few split off to get into another line leading into a separate room where the Omicron chapter of Delta Kappa Gamma is set up handing out backpacks full of the things every child needs for school.
Do you like your backpack?
Yeah, a lot.
It has a peace sign on it. It's kind of multicolor.
8-year-old Lana Prescott is going to the third grade this year. She's standing in line with her 11-year-old sister, Michaela, who is moving into the sixth grade.
We're just getting some of our school supplies. Mama saved up school supplies from last year, like pencil boxes and glue sticks and stuff like that.
The girl's mother, Crystal, is on the other side of the room, keeping a close eye. She says the past 2 years, she's gotten as many supplies as possible from the pantry.
Even with one child, the list that they give you at school is so long, even here at the food pantry, they can't provide possibly all the supplies. So I still will have to buy more supplies, but it is a great deal of help.
Helping the parents is what most members of Delta Kappa Gamma say is their motivation.
And the students themselves, they're thrilled. They're thrilled to be able to get a backpack and have most of their supplies in it.
Millie Martin is a member of the service group. She says her children are grown and in their 40s now, but she remembers what it was like to get them ready for that first day of school.
Well, boy, what do we need to have? What do we have to get? And we did have to do that.
But she says she also remembers the lists back then were different.
It was not quite as complex as it appears to be today. It surprises me many times the things that the teachers do ask for that I know some people simply can't afford.
After a quick Google search, I found the supply lists for West Homer Elementary, Homer Middle School, and Homer High School. The supplies, of course, varied by grade, but there were similarities in each list. Each kid needed notebook paper, binders, pencils, and erasers. Plus, they needed their arts and crafts supplies, and gym shoes. And then there were calculators and protractors for older kids. When I spoke with West Homer Principal Ray Marshall about Delta Kappa Gamma's work, he had nothing but praise.
We have a large school supply list, I guess, and sometimes it's hard to put together. They do a fantastic job making sure that kids, just removing barriers for children. Every teacher in our school will spend hundreds or thousands of dollars a year on snacks, on school supplies, on, you know, bolstering their professional education. I mean, this is a great helping hand for teachers.
The principal added the current supply list hasn't changed since he started at West Homer, and he doesn't think it's much different from others he's seen throughout his career, even while serving in other states. Delta Kappa Gamma's members say they help about 100 students in the Kachemak Bay area get supplies every school year, and there's always a need for more as the school year moves forward. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal and Danny Rupik in Unalaska, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Matthew Smith in Nome, and Quentin Chandler in Homer. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Where can you see more than 1,000 entertainers, from Alaska Native dancers to dinosaurs? The Alaska State Fair. This year, everyone attending the fair can enjoy music free with fair admission, like Riders in the Sky, Young Dubliners, Redhead Express, Savannah Jack, Home Free, and Kentucky Lineman. Learn more at thealaskastatefair.org. Music, fair food, and good time fun. It's what the Alaska State Fair is all about. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.